from KFNX News Talk Radio 1100, it's Chatterbox, where you'll find the latest news, interviews, and updates about the gaming world. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host, the guests, and callers only, and not necessarily those of KFNX News Talk Radio 1100. And now, here's your hosts for Chatterbox.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Chatterbox Video Game Radio. My name is Ara.
And I'm Colin.
And once again, for the second consecutive week, our hero Alon's not here.
He's in the Bahamas.
Is he still there?
I think so.
Yeah.
Or the Cancun, wherever. He's off in some tropic area.
So hopefully he's still alive, at least. And if he's not, that would be really bad.
He's probably burnt. He's probably burnt to hell. Like, just...
That would just like that. He's so burned that it's causing shockwaves across the air. So I guess obviously he can't call into us from way over there. Otherwise, he would run up an extremely expensive phone bill, which would be totally fine by me. But I guess he probably doesn't want to do that. Anyway, just like you heard, guys, this is Chatterbox. We talk about video games. And what are we going to start with? Let's start with some quick things. Like, I know you don't want me to say this, but I'm going to say it to Colin. I saw this commercial today, right? I didn't know what game it was for. It was really dramatic. It had all these camera sweeps. It had all these explosions. It had all these evil-looking characters. I'm like, what is this hot new movie coming out?
This is Jimmy. It's StarCraft 2.
Yeah, it's StarCraft 2. And I'm like, wait a minute. I thought this was an FPS, right? Is it still an FPS?
No.
What's going on here? No?
What are you talking? Are you serious?
It's not an FPS
anymore? Are you serious?
Of course I'm serious.
I don't understand. This game came out 10 years ago, and you don't know that it's an RTS.
RTS, that's what I meant to say.
Okay. Yeah, it's
you can blame that on my dyslexia.
Yeah, it's still an RTS.
Which started 5 minutes ago. An RTS.
Yes.
It's still an RTS, right?
A real-time strategy game.
Right. Right? Still?
Yes.
Okay. So I always find that funny that whenever we advertise games, like as an industry, it's like we're too ashamed to show a game for what it is. Like it can't stand up on its own. So we have to resort to cinematic theatrics to convince people it's cool.
It's like the Knights of the Republic trailers. You've seen those? They're like these epic trailers with Jedis fighting Sith. They break into like the Citadel, kill everybody. But the real gameplay is nothing like that. There's not. It's an MMO. It's an MMORPG. There's no like real action one-to-one movement there. So
right.
I wonder how many people actually are getting sold on these like crazy trailers, and they're going to pick up the game and be like, this is nothing like that.
It's industry-wide. I mean, ever since, even back in the day when, you know, like Genesis days, Super Nintendo days, a lot of companies tried as hard as they could to never show the game as is, right? And I've always kind of been an opponent of that, I guess you could say, because I think that if the game is good, the way the game looks should be worthwhile to show. And yet we just continuously, even now when games look amazing, we find something to hide behind as an industry, as if we're afraid of actually showing the game for what it is.
I think I'm part of the problem, though, because I really did like that StarCraft 2 commercial.
Yeah,
it's
an
epic commercial.
Yeah, well...
And the game is great. Like, I've played the multiplayer before. I haven't played the single player yet, but I hear it's amazing, too. Like, it's all balanced. You should probably... But it's $60 for a PC game.
Well, they know what they're doing. I mean, look, how many years have they taken? You can pay $60, right?
But it's... You need to buy StarCraft, the first one. Then you have to pay pay $60 for the other two, so it's going to be $180 to play all three of the StarCraft campaigns. Because there's two expansion packs on top of the first one. The first one's only the Terran campaign, the human campaign. The next one, I think, is like the Zerg campaign. The next one's the Protoss campaign. So you're going to be paying $180 to get all three of these games, the whole single-player campaign.
Or you could just buy one if you wanted.
Yeah, but I'm not a noob. I wouldn't do that.
Well, it's Blizzard. What can I say? Okay, so... There's a couple of other little things that I definitely want to cover before we get some serious steam tonight. That was not intended to be a joke, by the way.
Oh.
I know how much you like steam. So apparently, we were kind of talking about this last week. Apparently, the sales of retail boxed copy games is almost about the same unit for unit in volume as digitally distributed games already. Isn't that crazy?
For reals?
In 2009, PC, let's look at this. This is a set of statistics that the MPD recently published. So they said in 2009, there were 21.3 million full game PC titles downloaded legally. And 23.5 retail box copies sold. So that's like pretty close.
That is pretty insane.
Only 2 million more they're actually selling retail copies of than digital copies of.
I wonder how much, well, like the digital copies, I'm sure those aren't all $60 games or $50 games. I'm sure they're
counting. No, just whatever they are. I'm sure they're counting as many things as they can. Although this is mentioning only PC downloads. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure your $5 game off Steam counts as one unit, but
yeah.
I'm sure also that you could go to the store and get a game for $5 if you really want it.
I just think that...
I'm surprised it's... Like, that's fast. I'm surprised it's happening that fast. I'm surprised that people are more... Or as accommodating or acclimating, that's an even better word to use, to this whole digital distribution model, because... I mean, I'll pay for a game either way, but I would always prefer to buy a real boxed copy if I had the choice. Right? And in fact, I'll even go a step farther, and I would say that I probably buy fewer purely digital games than I would otherwise for the fact that I'm not actually getting a physical copy that I can hold on to indefinitely.
So if they sent you some kind of totem or something like that, they sent you like good old games. They send you the PDF file of the entire... manual of those old games, like those old PC games. Would that be something similar to that? If you still had the game, you could play it on your PC.
No, I want a box. I want to put it on a box. I want to put it on my shelf. I want to say in 20 years, I can go back to that shelf and go back to that box and still play that game, and I can do whatever the heck I want with that game. If it sucks, I can sell it and get rid of it. If it doesn't suck, I can keep it for my collection. These are the things I wish to do with video games.
I just love that, like, games that I've broken. Like, I actually have a thing of StarCraft. I still had the beta key for it, but the discs were, like, all scratched up. They're scratched up. I couldn't even use them. I put the beta key in on Battle.net.com, and I was able to download a digital copy of it, link it to my account, and now I have StarCraft forever now. And I can just download it whenever. And I thought that was just a great, like, I had a broken copy, and now I can just download it whenever.
That's cool.
Yeah, it was great ashes to ashes kind of thing.
Yeah, and I guess it's a little bit different with PC versus, like, let's say Xbox.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, with PC, you have more easily – you're more easily in the situation where you can have – there's almost unlimited data. Like, you don't have to worry about how much data you have left, right? Like, my Xbox hard drive is the old hard drive. It's the 20-gig hard drive.
I have the same –
just like you, right? So it's like – yeah, I could go and buy the 120 gig, but I'm not a flagrant spender, so I don't engage in such frivolities. But so one of the concessions I have to make because of that is I have to be a little more choosy about what I download.
And I totally understand. I have like 3 gigs left, and I want to go buy Mass Effect 1 on Xbox so I can play through Mass Effect 2, and I have no room to fit that game. And I'm trying to install like Fallout 3 on my computer just on my Xbox to run faster, but I have no room to put that on there either. I'm out of space,
right,
pretty much.
Right. So, yeah, that was interesting. That's even more interesting. You hear that back then?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, I think we're getting invaded.
Sounds like dinosaurs.
I think we might be a different radio station. There we go.
It's a dramatic chipmunk.
Right. I was about to say, I think we might be a different radio station in a few minutes.
I want more of those.
So in other news, this is – I'm completely even more amazed by – this came out of – I don't know. You tell me, Colin, did it come out of left field for you as much as it did for me? Jailbreaking is now legal.
I cannot believe it, actually.
Do we have, like, an applause sound effect or something? Because we need to play that for, like, 20 continuous minutes.
No, I guess not.
No, it'll come, like, 2 minutes late, and then maybe we can have it playing through the whole show. Really? It's legal? The government actually did something for the benefit of consumers everywhere?
Well, the EFF, they're trying to... There we go. The EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, has been fighting for this for, like, the past, like, ever since the DMCA was passed. They've been, like, saying this is a bad idea, and they finally got, like, there was a lot of stuff they asked for, and this is one of the concessions they got, and that's amazing. I'm so happy that I can actually, like, root my phone now, and I won't feel like I just did something terrible or arrested for it.
For once, you as a consumer have rights. You can do what you want to your stuff.
There we go.
Yeah, so that was really, really flipping cool.
And games, too. You can break the DRM game to look for security vulnerabilities and fix them.
Right. Or so there's not just one thing they announced, right? They announced a series of things that are now you're able to do. So that's one of them. I think the let's see here. I think that the specific wording goes something like if you need to do something to make sure that the DRM is not going to completely F up your computer, then you're allowed to do that, which makes perfect sense.
What about archival purposes? Is that still legal? Can you still like rip games for archival purposes and play them?
I don't know. That sounds kind of touchy.
Yeah.
I don't know if we have that quite yet. But no, that's always been okay, hasn't it?
Yeah,
actually?
That's what I'm thinking. I'm just not sure.
Yeah.
All right. What's up next?
It's just been one of those things, right? It's just been one of, that's like, you know, yeah, you can say you have an archived copy of one that you paid for. You know, everybody says that, right? So let's see. What else have we got going on? There's I've talked about this in a couple shows in the past, but Muramasa, I'm still playing Muramasa.
How many swords you got?
I don't know, like 57 or something.
Ooh.
So this is another game I'm amazed with because you ever hear people talking about what depth is in games, right? Like this game is deep, this game is shallow, right? And it's a lot of times when people talk about that subject, it's kind of hard to illustrate like what depth really, really means, right? So just in me playing this game recently, I found a good way to explain this. This game has really, really deep mechanics. And you may ask me, Colin, you may ask,
What does depth mean in this game?
Or you could say, why is Muramasa so deep? What makes it so deep? And the amazing thing about this game is that, you know, 6-7 hours into the game, even longer than that, I am already continuing to form new strategies about how to play. I'm still learning about how to get better at the game. Right? And I think that really distills it down to a point. You know, if you can play a game for so many hours, if you feel like you're improving your skill or getting better at it or improving your performance or just making better decisions based on what you've learned over the past, you know, let's say 10 hours, that's deep stuff.
Yeah. I still haven't played it, but from everything that you've been talking about, it seems like this game, like, can you give me an example of, like, how you got better?
Well, I'm going to do my best to keep this from getting boring because I'm going to have to explain some of the specific mechanics to you, right? But here's one of the beautiful things about the depth of mechanics in this game is that in really early level play, when you're not so good at it, because of the way the controls are set up, a lot of your actions in the game involve basically tapping the button as fast as possible and pressing different directions, right? As you get better over time, you learn the timing of the moves and how they connect to each other, and you do less just random mashing, right? You learn to basically be self-disciplined with your inputs, and your performance gets better over time. So anyway, that's the music. We'll be back, guys.
Welcome back to Chatterbox Video Game Radio.
That's right. We've got plenty of show left this time. And as always, we've got to mention our wonderful sponsor. That's right, UAT, the University of Advancing Technologies. Technology, right?
Yeah, technology.
Yeah, and only one technology advances. Not all of them.
But if you want
to learn, fortunately, they've got that one. Right?
Yes.
Yes.
If you want to learn about video game design and crazy electronic engineering stuff, lasers that are microphones, go to that place.
That's right. Their site's uat.edu. And that's all we got to say about that one. All
right.
So before we went to break, I was trying my darndest to explain the coolness of the depth and the mechanics of Muramasa. And there's one little detail that I left out, so I wanted to be sure to mention that. Right. So the beauty of that game is that even when, you know, when you're doing a lot of mashing, right, the control scheme is lenient enough that you can play adequately that way, right? Like, there's nothing wrong with doing that. In fact, like, you can perform pretty competently because your extra inputs that you mash, it just ignores, just like normal, right? I mean, most games do that, right? But when you can still improve on that, right? And you can improve on subtle ways in your execution of the mechanics. And this actually happens over a span of like 10 hours, right? And so this is really cool. It's hard to think about how like one might go about like actually deliberately designing something in that way. So I'm curious about if they actually knew that was going to be the case while they were developing it. While on the other hand, right, like this game is actually the third in a very, very loosely tied together series of games. So they basically, this is their third iteration on the game or a game system that this company, Vanillaware, has worked on, right? The previous one was Odin Sphere.
Which is great.
Which was also great. The previous one to that was Princess Crown.
Was it their mini RTS? The one that was like the... It doesn't matter. Go on.
No, I don't think it was that. But anyway, so like the other interesting thing is that your consumption and use of items, they did something really smart in this game where you, in Odin Sphere, they had like six different stories you could play, right? And this one, they only have two. And the pattern for all the stories across both games was actually very, very similar. So what I ended up doing was, you know, in Odin Sphere, I basically just played the first story. Then I got bored after that. But for some reason or another, I can't really put my finger quite on it, but I didn't get that same sense of I'm bored with this after finishing the first story, the first sequence in Muramasa, right? So I play the first sequence, then I play the second one, right? And here's the interesting thing. So there's differences between the two, and there's a lot of similarities between those two stories in the game, right? The differences are, you know, there's different graphics, there's different characters, there's a different story. And you have, for example, there's a different set of weapons for each, you know, of the male and the female characters. But structurally, everything's almost identical, right? So you find out a few things from your first playthrough that you can apply to your second, but you only learn them kind of at the end of the first playthrough. So, for example, right, I found out that, you know, when we play these games, especially when we're playing for the long term, we have these kind of like resource management habits, right? And everyone has like a different set of them depending on their history with games, right? For example, you know, the way I play games is I don't use resources until I really need them. I mean, I think most people with experience with games do that, right? Like, so for example, if you have five healing items, right?
Yeah.
You don't want to use them until you absolutely need them.
Well, my favorite experience of that was when I was playing Shenmue 3, and then, like, I got to the very end of the game, and I just had, like, all these, like, crazy items, and I killed the final boss with, like, all of those.
Right, and yeah. Then it's like you lost them, right?
Yeah.
So here's the cool thing about this game, is that since you go through the game twice, and it's different enough each time to hold your interest, at least it was for mine, the first time through, yeah, I was like, I had, like, I ended the game with, like, 30,000 units of money in the game. Which is a lot. Like, most things in this game cost, like, 100-something units of money. Okay? So I was like, whoa. That was a major miscalculation here. I can spend a lot more on stuff when I'm playing through the game than I could the first time through. Right? So that's what I'm doing the second time through. The actual, like, dynamics and feeling of the experience was completely different. Just because I knew that I would never run out of, let's say, cash resources. I knew that I would always be able to get more. Like, my rate of acquiring cash through the scope of, like, you know, this, like, I don't know, 8 to 10 hour game for one story, let's say. I knew that I would never run out, and I would always get more at a faster rate, even if I do run out, right? So now I'm playing this game, and I'm spending money like crazy. I'm buying everything I can all the time. And it's just, it's really, it's actually letting me go through the game faster, right? But it's just a really cool feeling to be able to have that knowledge and apply it and have the game feel different. So this is something that this game has done for me that I got to say very, very few games have.
We got a question from the chat room here.
Yeah.
Is there any item creation in Muramasa? Like, can you combine items or forge items?
No.
I know that Odin Sphere had that. You can do the cooking minigames and stuff like that.
Yes, and I'm actually curious what the what our chat room compatriots think about this, because I thought that the item combining system in Odin Sphere was really, really interesting, but over long-term play, it became incredibly laborious.
It's tedious. It's really tedious when you go through it.
Yeah, and that's an understatement. Like, that's one of the reasons, actually, that I stopped playing the game was because I was sick of combining and recombining and uncombining all of the potions and stuff like that.
But what do you think about game like...
But Muramasa doesn't have any of that. And I'll tell you this, it's not missing anything interesting for not having that feature. At least in my opinion. So if you liked it, go play Odin's Fear More, I guess. And if you didn't, then it's a nice change.
Get Muramasa if you want something streamlined. So do we want to start talking about Limbo?
Yeah, I guess it's about that time.
All right, well, let's just talk about it before we get all the interpretation stuff. Let's talk about it purely from a gameplay standpoint. I beat the game. You played the demo. You went through it. What did you think?
I played the demo. Now, this was interesting. You knew my hesitations coming in, and I knew my hesitations.
Your disdain.
I wouldn't even go that far because I would just say hesitation, because I always look at everything critically when I play it for the first time. So I'm just going into this thing like, I'm not expecting it to be crap. I'm not expecting it to be great. I know that people have said a lot of great things, but then there's myriad repressed memories of my childhood of playing bad
games.
So you're
trying to go in neutral.
So I'm doing my best to be neutral about it, right? So my neutral assessment based on what I played, obviously the game artistically is beautiful. In terms of the way it looks and the way it moves, I mean, that's top-notch stuff. No question about that.
It's definitely got an amazing art style. Like, just like the little kids, like, all you can see is white eyes and his, like, shadow, his outline. And then these crazy death animations, they're just, like, it's beautiful but so grotesque at the same time. You'll walk in a bear trap and get your head cut off, and you'll feel repulsed, but it still has this great art style of, like, blood's going everywhere. And it just looks really cool. And you feel bad for the little guy. You start to build up, like, I had a friend, and he was saying that he really felt a companionship with this character just because of how, like, brutal these deaths were and how he really controlled that and how he felt bad about how this all happened.
Yeah, there is a – it's funny because the control package that you have, I mean, it's very straightforward. You basically just move left and right. You can jump, and then you have an action button. And that's pretty much it, right?
Yeah. And you can grab stuff.
So, right. Well, that's the action button.
Yeah.
Right. So where was I going with this, Colin? Help me out in my old age.
We were talking about game mechanics and just how...
Yeah, so everything's very, very fluid. Here's the thing, though, that I wasn't really impressed by, was that, you know, everything looks great. Everything is done with an impeccable sense of art. You know, I mean, like, it's so fluid. It's very, very polished. I mean, there's nothing that looks wrong. You know, there's nothing where I can look at and say, like, that this was wrong. Everything's very intentional, all that stuff, right? But none of that cool stuff was what's the best way to put this? Let me put it to you this way, Colin. The things that really excite me in games are the things that games can only do. Let me put it to you that way, right? And from what I played of Limbo so far, all of the great, beautiful things about it seemed to me to be kind of ancillary, at least in terms of what normally gets me excited. Does that make sense?
I understand. From knowing you on the show, it seems like you're more of a systems-based player. Like, you like to find the systems in games and kind of exploit them but exploit them in terms of getting better, learning how they work, and then playing to your advantage. And then versus narrative-based games, where it's more like reading a book and experiencing the story from the first hand. Is that right?
Right. That's a pretty good observation. You know, it's kind of, I mean, it's the good old dichotomy of narrative versus gameplay.
Yes.
And we'll talk more about that when we come back from this break.
Woo!
Alright, we're back once again. It's Chatterbox Video Game Radio, and we've been talking about Limbo, the game, not the dance.
The Xbox Live Arcade game.
Yes, that's right. Let me give out our phone number before we continue. If any one of you gentlemen or ladies would like to call in, our number is 866-536-1100. Maybe you played Limbo. Maybe you have an opinion about it. Maybe you think Colin's full of crap. Maybe you think I'm full of crap.
All right. So when we were talking about Limbo, we were focused on just the game mechanics and how the game doesn't do a whole lot that hasn't been done in games before. But I think...
Well, let me before you address that.
Okay.
Right? I got to respond to what you just said about the game doesn't do things that haven't been done before. Let me make it clear that, I'm not one of those people that is, like, dependent on sheer novelty in order to hold a game up. I don't think that games have to be completely novel for them to be meaningful or important. And I don't think that they have to be novel in every which way that they possibly can try to be in order for them to be that.
Okay.
So
let me rephrase what I said. That this is a game that has that can do things that does things that can't only be done in video games. This game takes a lot of inspiration from a lot of movies and amazingly a lot of like paintings and stuff. Just the way that it presents its art and the way that it's got these beautiful animations and the way that it presents its world. Cartoons especially, just the depth in that game, the way that it shows the three different panels, like Little Big Planet. It's got that depth to it, too.
Okay.
And I think that's an important part of how the game looks.
Okay, what's this three panels? What's going on here?
Okay, in Little Big Planet, you know, there's the depth. It's a 2D game.
And oh, you mean how there's three levels? There's the
foreground, the background, and the midground, like the whole...
Oh, yeah, but, you know, that's a conventional technique.
Well,
and,
yeah.
I mean, you know, lots of games and film and, you know...
Yeah, well, I was just saying that's where it draws all of its look from. Like,
sure.
This is like an example of something that it
sure.
does.
Sure. So does Muramasa, though.
Exactly. Well, I'm just saying that that's an example of something that it does that isn't done and that is done in other media forms.
Okay.
Specifically, in just things that I think the game does well better, that it will do better than a cartoon or, say, a painting or something like that, is the way that you kind of have to – it's a puzzle game, so you kind of have to force your character to go through this. And he's going to die a lot. The game is, like, really freaking with checkpoints, but this character is going to die a lot. And the more you do these things, the more you kill him, I think the more you feel closer to this character. The more you become tied to his goal. No matter, even though it's like ambiguous of what he's going towards.
Right.
Just that fact that you're controlling him and you are killing him. You're making him do these gratuitous death scenes.
Like, do you actually feel this?
I'm not making this up.
This is interesting because I got none of that feeling of attachment whatsoever. You know, maybe I have been desensitized to the violence of games over the years.
I know the exact point. It's when I was jumping in those spike pits, and then you see him just put his hand out and try to crawl, and then it just drops and his eyes go black.
Yeah.
Just that, I think that's really powerful for, like, just a platformer in general. And I know this isn't the first time it's been done, but this, the whole art style really got to me.
Yeah. I can see that. I can see that, and I can appreciate that. And it's funny because you're actually really astute about describing my preferences in games. And you're absolutely right, because that is, you know, okay, so like myself, right, like I like to reduce things down to their systems and how they work, right? So looking at it systematically, most of my experience involves, oh, okay, I went there, I died, I went there, I died, I went there, I died, right?
Right.
You told that story in a very different way. Get it?
Yeah, I know. You're more of a ludic kind of guy.
So, you know what, there's no right or wrong with that. We'll get to something else I'll tell you that you're wrong about, but I don't think there's any right or wrong with that one. But let me explain to you what happened to me when I was playing the demo.
Okay.
Right? Because there were certain things that frustrated me about it. And maybe, you know, me being very systems-oriented, maybe these are things that are important to me that perhaps for a lot of people they can let that go. You know, or they can, you know, just maybe it's a... To me, it's an important thing, right? Maybe to them, it's like an ancillary thing, right? So, for example, just the way that you solve puzzles, right? I didn't get through a lot of the puzzles in the game. I got to, you know, the spider, and I couldn't figure out the spider. Maybe in a moment you can tell me what the spider does or how to defeat the spider, right? But there were, you know, there were like two or three or four puzzles on the way to the spider, and, you know, most of them were trivial. There was one that was just kind of like awkward and weird, right? But a lot of my experience basically was distilled down to, you know, me moving back and forth on the plane I was allowed to and pressing buttons when I could, right, to see if they did anything. And then when I couldn't do that, I just went backward a little bit until I got to the point where there was something that I could interact with, right?
Right.
And this kind of trial and error exploration of the space of what you can do is completely unsatisfying to me.
Really?
Yes. And when I got to, because it's largely a lot of it is blind. Now, a lot of it isn't blind, and the part of it that isn't blind and is logical is great. But the part of it that feels blind, when you feel like you're frustrated and you don't know what to do, and your problem-solving process has just been reduced to, you know, let me press inputs in places I haven't yet pressed inputs, that's a very unsatisfying experience. Even when you solve get to a solution at that point, it doesn't even feel like you've done anything meaningful, because in actuality you haven't. You know, you've accidentally tripped on something to get to the answer, you know.
I had the exact opposite experience whenever I was playing this game. I would try, just kind of like going blindly with it, and just because I wanted to speed through it as fast as possible to get to, like, if I got to a puzzle I couldn't figure out in like a minute, I would just be like, okay, I'm just going to try everything and try to do it.
Right.
And then when I take a step back and come back to it, just think about it logically,
right,
got me the answer. Like, one puzzle had you trying to move I'm going to ruin this part for anyone who wants to hear it, so they probably should turn off the podcast for about 5 seconds. You have to move a tire across two different platforms, and you can push the platforms back and forth. So I kept trying. I just kept trying the same thing over and over again, thinking that it would somehow work, and maybe I'm not doing fast enough. And then I had a buddy who was watching over my shoulder. He's like, you are an idiot. You're doing this completely wrong. I'm like,
So he knew the answer.
He did know
the answer. Just by watching, and you can figure it out.
So I'm like, all right, fine, figure it out. He did it in one turn. He's like, you should have done this the whole time. He knew exactly what to do just by watching me play it. It was just like jumping over the you had like a certain amount of time, you just jump over the actual platform that you're pushing and then push it.
Right.
Yeah.
So here's the interesting thing. When you have a clue, or you feel like you have a clue, or there's something that you feel like that you can still try, then it's interesting, right? When you go up to that wall, which, you know, just for idiosyncratic reasons people do, that's when it gets really frustrating. Now, we've got a call from Justin in...
Oh, God.
I'm going to guess this is Queen Creek, because we don't have a Green Creek, and have a Green Creek in Arizona. Is that right, Justin?
You're right, Queen Creek.
Hi, Justin.
On, Queen Creek. Fantastic. Now, do you have a comment about Limbo, or perhaps something else?
Yeah, I'm totally with Colin here. Like, the more you progress in Limbo, the more you, like, feel for this kid. And even though you're saying, like, the puzzle feels monotonous, there's, like, not much to it, which I'll agree with you for some amount of that. But, like, I think you just create such a relationship with this kid. And like Colin said, it's like, I'm killing this poor guy. And
now, I find this...
That's a lot of the fun to it.
Right. Now, I find this ironic. Maybe you can comment about this, Justin, and you too, Colin, that you guys both feel this sense of attachment, yet the only ways that you guys have of actually communicating with the character, right, are moving, jumping, dying, and I guess not dying.
That's what's so great about it, though, is that your main form of communication with him, the main way you get emotion from him, is by killing him in the worst ways possible. And I think that's what separates this game from a lot of things. There's no cutscenes. All of the whole start and ending of this game is ambiguous, but just the main emotional value you get from it is just him getting his head cut off. And, like, I'm not saying that to be funny. That would make us a little bit ridiculous, but him falling into a pit of spikes, and you keep doing this over and over again, his death animation changes every time, and I think that's great.
What do you think about that, Justin?
I don't know. I think a lot of this, to me, like, probably no one else feels like this, but I felt for him, like, you just keep falling back down, and then you keep getting up, and I just feel for his struggle, you know? Like,
he definitely seems to struggle, especially in the water.
But you feel bad, because I think I could relate, like, you keep falling down, the further you go, it just keeps getting worse and worse. Like, you're doing so great, and then the next minute, you know, you got decapitated by a bear trap.
So what was your overall experience? How would you describe that with this game? What did you think of the game, Justin?
I liked it a lot, and really, I don't even care for puzzle games, mostly. And I think definitely the kind of creepy eeriness with this drew you in a lot, too, or at least me. And then, like I said, just the relationship you build with the character is phenomenal. I mean, especially since he doesn't talk. I mean, it's not anything more than a silhouette with some light eyes, you know. I don't know. I think it's great, and how it does that is crazy.
Now, did you play through the entire game?
I beat the game, yeah.
All right, so this is cool, because we've got two people who beat the game. I didn't get past the spider. Which Colin says,
is easy.
I should be laughed at for that. But Here's an interesting thing that I've heard about this game that I'd like you, Justin, to comment on. You know, just reading reviews and blogs and so on about this, is that there's a lot of really vague symbolism. I took Colin to task before the show on this, too. There's a lot of really vague symbolism in the game, right? Now, do you think that the symbolism in the game, or do you think, let me put it this way. Man, we're coming up on a break again. Okay, you know what? We're going to take the break. If you can hang on, Justin.
Sure.
I'll finish my thought, and then we'll get your thoughts on it, and then everyone will give their thoughts, and it'll be awesome. All right, we'll be back.
It's me, Mario. You're listening to Chatterbox Video Game Radio. It's a number one. Woo-hoo!
We're back on Chatterbox Video Game Radio Show.
All right.
And we're talking about Limbo and its various interpretations.
Yes, and okay, so Justin's still with us. You still here, Justin?
Yes, sir.
Fantastic. Okay, so let me start over. Here's what I was trying to say. So there's a lot of symbolism and there's a lot of vagueness in Limbo. Now, this seems to be the origin of a lot of people's fascination of this game. And the thing that I find funny is that lots of people, you know, when they write about the game, they'll say, oh, well, you know, this event here, this represents that and that, you know, those two kids over there, that represents that. And you smashing through this piece of glass, that means something else. And everyone's got their own interpretations. And in fact, if you start reading all the interpretations, you start realizing everyone has a lot of very different interpretations.
Yes, it's a lot like if anyone's seen Inception and then those like various like breakdowns of that movie, it's a lot like that. I'm drawing a parallel to that game because it's both about dreams and it's both about, like, at least I think it's both about dreams,
right,
considering the game is named Limbo.
Right. Now, here's my question for you, Justin. One, did you think that the symbolism in the game was deliberate and obvious? And two, was that part of why you enjoyed the game or no?
When he says deliberate, he means designed, kind of, right? You mean designed.
Right.
I think it's definitely more or less about that. I mean, because, like I said, the gameplay, you know, it's kind of, as far as if you took away the whole story, it'd just be another puzzle game. But, I mean, the fact that they don't reveal any plot for you made me want to just play it that much more and progress, you know, kind of, maybe in this next chapter I'm going to find out what the heck is going on. But, I mean, I think that definitely motivated you, and the whole mystique of it just made it a lot more fun. And like I said, they don't really tell you, you know, what happened, so when you beat it, you know.
Right. So how did you feel when you beat it? Did you feel accomplished, or did you feel like there was something missing?
Oh, I felt accomplished. I mean, you play through that game, you see some of those puzzles, and you look back and see it's only 24 chapters, but how long did it take you when you sat there? Like, you know, Colin was talking about the tire part. I feel for him. I spent an hour trying to jump on a box that I didn't even need to be on, then when I figured out, I slapped myself in the face. Like, it was that easy.
I have to disagree about the ending. I do agree that the puzzle parts of it were, like, the ending puzzle is insane, and I felt really accomplished after I'd beaten it. But the story wrap-up, I felt like it was too vague for my liking. Like, I didn't – the payoff at the end of this game, I didn't agree that it was the be-all, end-all. Like, I was kind of disappointed by the ending. I don't want to ruin it for anybody, but the ending, I didn't like it as much, the way that it left it vague and ambiguous.
Right, right.
Well, yeah, it left it vague, but I think that was kind of the fun for me. It's like, because like you said, everyone's got their own interpretation, and what I came up with may very well might not be the same that either of you would, but I thought that was kind of fun, too.
All right.
In the opinion, what I think it is, and it could be different for anyone else.
For sure.
Right on. So do you have anything left to add, Justin?
I think that's good for me.
All right, well, thank you very much for your call. You guys know that we always like hearing from you. Now,
bye, Justin.
We got to mention UAT again, uat.edu.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Our wonderful sponsor. But I didn't.
Oh.
That's why they pay me the big bucks here, Colin. So go to their website, uat.edu. You can learn about making games, University of Advancing Technology. Now, what else do we got here? I think we can move on from Limbo. Do you want to still talk about more Limbo? How do you defeat the spider? That's
okay.
What
the spider?
Do you, okay,
just,
because
okay. Did you see the bear trap right before you came to the spider?
There was one. Okay,
hanging on the ledge.
Okay.
Yes.
Saw that. Tried. The only thing I can think of. Let me tell you what I did try, and then you can tell me the silly, obvious thing that I missed. Okay. So, saw the bear trap hanging on the tree. Right. So okay, obviously this is involved with killing a giant spider one screen to the right. Okay, figured that part out, right? So I jumped around there, couldn't figure out what to do. I jumped around and then pressed action at the same time. Can't reach the bear trap, right?
Okay.
So I was like, okay, let me, you know, because the first time I walked up to the spider and it just, you know, it just lanced me just right through the middle of the little boy's body and got killed right away.
Which
right?
is awesome.
So I tried playing around with the spider a bit, right?
Yeah.
So I figured out that you could actually... like with timing, like jump around a little bit and have the little legs miss you until like it actually hits you once and then kills you, right?
Right.
But couldn't figure out anything in there. So I couldn't figure out. That's the point where I gave up. The only thing where I think where it could be is maybe I had to backtrack more than I did to get to it.
No. What you needed to do was when that spider leg's going down on you, just yeah. wait for it to go down, then back up. Like, it's going to target you, and then you can
did
tell...
Did that. Did totally did
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so have him do that three times. The bear trap will fall.
Three times.
Yes. Well, okay, you need to play this game with the sound on. I'll tell everyone that. You need to play this game with the sound turned up, because you can hear it move as it hits that.
That's
you can hear
insanity.
The... Yes.
I did have sound on, okay? I wasn't in a THX-certified theater.
I have a crappy TV that I play with, and this whole game, please have the sound on, because a lot of the puzzles are sound-based. Like, you need to use yeah. the sound to help you.
Didn't hear that feedback at all. Didn't make that connection. This is going back to what I was saying earlier on the show. When you have a hint about what you can do, right, then you feel like you can make progress. When you don't have any hints, and by hints, I mean if you don't have a thought, right, whether it arrives by some kind of magical combination of neurons or from actual feedback in the game, which was in this situation, you know, some sound effect that apparently I didn't hear. Right? That I didn't pay enough attention to. If you don't have that, then you just feel completely useless.
Yeah.
I do find it interesting that, right, like your experience with like figuring out that puzzle and my experience with figuring out the puzzle is completely idiosyncratic in that, right, it was, there's no reason why I didn't hear it the time I played it, right? Like it wasn't because, like, you know, someone was smart enough or not smart enough or paying attention or not paying attention, right? It was just random.
Yeah.
Right? So, but that frustrates me even more to hear that that's the solution. Like, I have to do this, like, this action, it's completely contrived. Like, why is doing that three times?
I just think that it goes back to the old gaming trope of the rule of three. You know it's always
the rule of three.
It is.
Right.
Any boss fight that you do, it's a rule of three. That you have to kill three farms, that you have to do them three times. Like, I think that's a lot.
That's a cop-out.
I disagree, but
you know, if there was any, you know what, there's maybe I'll go back to it and listen for this sound, but there really wasn't enough feedback there to figure out that there was something going on, because even if it was a really loud sound, right, it's like, what changed? You know, like, you do, it's hard to tell that something changed.
Yeah.
Anyway,
moving on.
The thing, actually, I don't want to move on. I want to press on this for a little
bit
more.
I thought we were going to CalClicker.
Too bad. let me give you an example. Because these kinds of things come up all the time in lots of games. I'll give you an example to differentiate between the types of puzzles that I'm talking about. Right now, there's a certain kind of puzzle in a game, and lots of games have both of these, where you know you can consider them lateral thinking puzzles. Right, like one example of the lateral thinking puzzle is, for example, right in like one of the Metal Gear, I think it was the first one actually, Metal Gear Solid.
Yeah.
Right. There's one puzzle you have to figure out where it said, like, look in the back of the box for, you know, this codec that you need to contact this guy, right?
Oh,
I don't know if you remember
yeah,
that part.
Yeah, I know.
But
you
it's a lateral.
You need to look in the book and find.
Yeah, it's a lateral thinking puzzle. You have to. They are talking about something external to the game universe, and you had to make that connection that they weren't talking about a box somewhere in the game, but that they were talking about literal physical copy of the box you bought when you went to the store, right?
Yeah.
So that's lateral thinking, right?
But, which. He says, look in the game manual that you came with the box. Like, those are the exact words.
Did it say that?
It says, look in the game manual.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's really obvious, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so that completely destroys this example. But just pretend it didn't say that.
Okay.
Okay. Or here's another example, right? There was this...
The slot 2 port I'm thinking of, where he's like, you need to think differently here, and then he'll eventually give it to you if you can't figure it
right,
out. Yeah.
Right, right. But see, here's the thing with the with these lateral thinking puzzles, like, you can never solve them by a sheer application of logic, right? Like, you will never arrive at the answer if you go through a logical steps. Like, you just have to be able to make some sort of – that's why they call it lateral thinking – some sort of connection between two things that if you do – like, you either – this is the funny thing. You either tend to get them right away,
yeah,
or they take forever and you almost never get them.
It reminds you of right? the stupid point-and-click adventures where it's like you need to
right.
put this paint
that's,
with –
That's even better, right?
Yeah.
You apply this item to that thing in the room and something crazy happens that you would have never guessed, right?
So lateral thinking puzzles.
Right. Those, I think in general, those are bad designs because either the player tends to get them right away or they'll tend to get completely stuck on them.
Yeah.
Now, an example of another type of puzzle, which I think you can apply complete logic to, is, for example, there's this one part in Zelda Wind Waker. Right, where you had to stack up boxes on top of each other to reach this thing at the top of this room, right? And you have all the information you need to solve that puzzle. You can look at the boxes, and you can analyze like where you can you're allowed to move them and where you're not allowed to move them. You can figure out where to put them to get to the top. And that, to me, is a much nicer, much more pleasant experience because you can think it through.
Yeah.
If the puzzle gets too lateral... I mean, it's like you. I mean, either the path is open or it's a concrete wall. You know, it's very, very black and white. You know, I don't like that.
You're not creative, is what you're saying.
I'm creative.
I'm just kidding.
I just want to be able to get through the game without being that creative. All right. So once again, we've come to the end of the show.
We need to give a shout out to Cal Clicker. Go find
Cal Clicker.
On
yes,
Facebook.
We wanted to talk about that.
Maybe next week. Go try it out.
We'll talk about it next week. We'll plan to, anyways.
All right.
So that's it. That's the end of our show, guys. Thanks for listening. Once again, I'm Ara. That's Colin.
Alon's coming back next week.
Alon will be back next week. And we'll see you guys next week as well.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to Chatterbox Video Game Radio. Tune in next week for more tips and info and the latest and greatest in video gaming. And remember, all your base are belong to us.